Yeah, I know you've been traveling the city, Anthony, today, haven't you?
Mark, it has been so exciting. I have to tell you that it's been a long time since I have seen the kind of enthusiasm, long lines, and patience that people were exhibiting in the city of Baltimore. Early this morning, I got up with a bunch of folks around 5 o'clock this morning because a lot of our clients at I Can't, We Can't, where I spend a great deal of my time, were volunteering at the polls and wanted to work for their candidate of choice. And so I made sure that they had something to eat, some breakfast and all these things before everyone headed out this morning. And then I decided just to ride around the city all morning up until around lunchtime. And every polling place, Mark, had long lines. Around about 11:15, it started to rain pretty hard in certain parts of the city. Without umbrellas, people were standing in line. When I got out and was kind of polling some of the folks about how long they've been waiting, 2 and 3 hours to vote in the city of Baltimore.
A young woman who works here, Chris, was telling me she waited 2 hours in line to vote today.
So it's an exciting time here in Baltimore, across the country. People are engaged in this election in choosing the next president of the United States. It's very exciting for those of us who follow this game called politics.
You know, it's interesting. I remember this email here we got from Cleveland, Ohio. It said, I'm reporting from Cleveland, Ohio on this momentous day. I'm working in the Obama campaign. As you doubtless know, Cleveland was ground zero for voter suppression and intimidation in the last presidential election. And the campaign assigned us a lot of people here in Cleveland to work. But so far, things are running smoothly. A few dirty tricks, a little attempted intimidation, some machine problems, and some dense or hostile election judges. But all of this is the ordinary stuff of any election in any big U.S. city. The Obama campaign is incredibly well organized here. The sensible part of me is rooting for all to continue to go smoothly, and the childish part of me is wondering where all the action is. It would be fantastic to wake up to President-elect Barack Obama tomorrow morning. And that was a piece of mail we got from Cleveland, Ohio, where it is one of the states is being contended hotly. Later on in the next hour, we're going to hear from Mark Christopher Miller about voter suppression in America, the history of all that, and what's been going on in this election. We'll hear from Sherilyn Ifill, who co-chairs the task force on elections here in the state of Maryland, and of course is one of the great civil rights attorneys in the United States of America, who works at the University of Maryland Law School. Right now, I'm here with Melody Simmons and Anthony McCarthy. Anthony McCarthy will be with us the entire 2 hours before he takes over the ship all night long. I may stay with him a little while, but I will not be here all night long with my dear friend Anthony. He has too much company as it is. Later on in the hour, we're going to hear from Scott Simon and Debbie Elliott from National Public Radio. They're taking what's going on. And we'll also hear from Edward Luce, who is Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief from London. He's on the road with the Obama campaign. We'll hear from him as well. And people are calling in. We'll get your calls here, 410-319-8888, to hear your take on the day. Let me just tell a little story, then I'm going to hear some of the clips that have been prepared for us by Melody Simmons and Jessica Phillips, who helped put them all together for us today so we could hear Melody's work. But to take on this campaign, last night, the woman I live with, Valerie Williams, went out to Manassas to hear Obama, along with some other friends of ours who went down there. And she told me the story that should be up on our website of how when people left, the police didn't have enough exits open. So people were jammed tight, couldn't move in like snails. Thousands, tens of thousands of people moving like snails to get out. Young hip hoppers, older white women, Muslims in headscarves, regular working class folks, middle class people, students, black folks, Mexicans, all clammed in together. The same thing happened to me when I was leaving Avesco Stadium after Obama spoke, and it took us over an hour, the same kind of tight little packed people that could have led to a riot in any other place. But there is a sense out there, I think, that comes out of Barack Obama himself, of a kind of calming, of looking at this as a land of civility rather than confrontation. Very different auras in the two campaigns that way, I think. And I think that sense filled the people who came out to hear him. So what could have been a potentially explosive situation was very cool, thereby taking care of each other and walking quietly together. That's if that becomes the tenor of our nation, it might not be a bad thing.
Mark, that's a great story.
It is beautiful.
That's a great story.
I think we saw that same patience today at the polls, didn't we, Anthony?
I think you're right.
I was amazed at how many elderly voters came out in wheelchairs with walkers, the grandchildren helping them just to get out. The drive is to get out and vote. A lot of elderly who couldn't stand for long periods of time were standing in line in the rain with that same quiet strength. And almost as though this was a day of reckoning. Mm.
So which one of your of the people that you spoke today, before we go to the phones here, because I want to get them on the air with this, should we go to that kind of talks to that of the people that you've interviewed today?
I thought Miss Ruby Underwood, 86.
So, well, let's go to Miss Ruby Underwood, who's 86 years old. That's our second clip, and hear what she had to say, one of the voters in the city of Baltimore today. Can we go to that? Take our clip two? Okay, well, we'll wait until we get some producers inside so we can go to clip two here and hear the people that we've gotten on the air that Melody Simmons went out and recorded today. 410-319-8888.
Mark,
yes.
Can I tell you a story about Edna Harris, who lives here in the city, 95 years old. I have brunch with her every Sunday. She's one of my godmothers. Went out and voted today, and really was emotional. About 95 years old, she talks about being part of the old machines in Chicago. She talks about how black voters were intimidated in Indiana and Arkansas. Went out and voted today and came out and said, I never imagined at 95 I'd have the chance to vote for a black man for president of the United States. And not making a commentary about John McCain or anything, but at 95, in her lifetime, she had given that thought up.
Right.
But today, she got to at least cast a vote. We'll know a little bit later if, in fact, Barack Obama makes history. But in any case, history will be made today.
I think we're ready to hear Ruby Underwood, 86 years old, talks about it is time to break a record. Do we have her on? Okay, when we're ready to hear that, we'll go to hear that. And let's go to the phones here at 410-319-8888. And who's been holding on here? Sandy, you're on the air. We have Sandy?
Yes.
You're on the air. You there, Sandy?
Yes, I hear something else on the call, though.
Turn your radio down.
Is your radio turned down?
Okay.
All right, there you go, Sandy. You're on the air.
I'm calling. My name is Sandy Carter. I voted in Overly this morning, and I've been voting in Overly since, I want to say about 2000, and this was the first time I actually had to stand in line. I was surprised by that. Really, all I've heard, I was still surprised because no one ever votes in that area. And it was just such a really calm move. But I really want to thank you guys, your shows, and radio in general for making these issues so important, making the issues of election, making the issues of voting, making the issues of the candidates so important. Last week, I listened to the slots debate for a while, and I learned a lot.
Good.
I really want to thank you guys for all the help that you've done with making this election easy for so many more of us.
Thank you so much for that. I really do appreciate
that.
That is a
call.
Great deal, Sandy. Thank you so much. And I'm glad to hear these lines are long. They were long for me. It was 25 minutes long for me getting in today. How long did you wait in line to vote?
I voted about 2.5 weeks ago.
Smart man.
I'm not very patient when it comes to lines.
How about you? How long did you stay in line?
I did a drive-through. I actually went at a good hour and walked right in, registered, and voted. I was in and out in 5 minutes.
But, Mark, people are praising the Board of Elections folks here in the city of Baltimore. The lines are long. People are waiting a long time. But they're saying when they get in, they're able to get to the machine, the voter rolls are complete and up to date. They get your name, they get your ID, they send you to a machine, and you're out the door.
Yes.
It's just getting to that machine that's hard.
I have a picture of my 11-year-old that was sent to me by her mom, who is standing behind the sign with her little brother, and they're behind this Obama sign, peace signs. They have voted. It's great. Get out there and vote if you haven't done it. There's still time. 410-319-8888. Let's now go hear Ruby Underwood, 86 years old.
My certificate is to vote for Obama Biden. I believe he can do a lot for us because we do need changes.
You got up early to come out here.
Yes, I did. I got up early to come out and make sure I didn't miss the so I make sure I could vote. I'm 86 years old. I just hope and pray that Obama will be our next president.
Okay? And how about having a black president?
I think that'd be the best thing that could ever happen to us because we have been under the white president so long, and it's time to break a record. Thank God. Okay. Have a blessed day.
That was Miss Ruby Underwood, 86 years old, talking about it's time to break a record. And let's go to take four. This is Jane Velasquez and Robert Nichols, two first-time voters, to discuss their experience of voting.
This is our first time voting since we've been here in this country. We've been here 30 years, but this is our first time voting. And I feel good today. For me, being a first-time voter means a whole lot to me. My daughter woke me up this morning. She said, Mommy, be ready, be ready. And I just feel good.
So you're both new citizens, and Prophet, this is, you just became a citizen and got the right to vote last week.
Yeah.
So how was it? What was it like to get in there and vote in America?
Oh, real nice. I feel good. I feel real good.
And how about, this is a significant election because it is historic.
Yes, it is. For me, I think it is. And for everybody, I think it is. Because, like, I really never went into the politics of understanding different things. But see, now I'm interested in it. And this is my first time really being interested in where I live and what's happening and the health course and the medicine and everything, you know? We're just trying to make it, you know? And things is rough, truly rough. I went yesterday to get pop-up medicine, $300 and some just for one pill now. And you know, people, my people that's losing their homes and things after they've been here and try to, you know, have something, they're losing their homes and everything and stuff. It's just, we just need a change right now.
Let us go back to the phones here. I'm sitting here with my colleagues, Anthony McCarthy and Melody Simmons, taking your calls, talking about the election. Shortly we'll be talking to Scott Simon and Debbie Elliott from NPR to hear their thoughts on this election. And let's go to 410-319-8888. Tamika in Glen Burnie, you've been holding on a while. You're on the air.
Hello, Mark.
Hi,
good
Tamika.
Evening to you. Nice
good
to
evening.
Be on your program.
Good to have you with us.
Yep. I guess I just would like to let everyone know, I mean, I'm a 25-year-old young voter, so for me today it was very exciting to go to the polls. It wasn't my first time, but it was interesting, though, to see people who are older than me voting for their first time. And to all of those people, I just say congratulations. And, you know, I think that this time in history has awakened a lot of people just sitting here on the phone line listening to the last clip play. It just seemed like, you know, when she was saying that she wasn't, this is like one of the first times that she's listened to the political scene and things like that. And I must say for myself that it has been one of the first times that I've really taken a close ear to the policies and the concerns and the issues of America. But it's really an awakening. I really enjoy being a part of history today, and mm-hmm. I look forward to it happening again.
Tamika, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate those. Let me ask a question before you go, and I'm going to ask Anthony and Melody to comment on this. How many of your peers in their early, mid-20s are voting? Is there a large turnout among the people that you know? Tamika? Oh, did we lose her? Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Tamika, how many of your how many of your peers are voting, the people that you know very well who are in your age group?
Each and every person in my contacts list, and I know quite a few people. And if they haven't gone out to vote, then they are crossed off of my
Go ahead, my girl, to me. That's good.
Is this that serious? Marcus, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Is this that serious? I mean, I know nobody in my age group who has just decided to stay home. And again, I do know a lot of people. So, you know, it's something that... I've been getting text messages all day. We're a generation of MySpace and text message and mm-hmm. Facebook and this and that. And there is just no excuse among those 25 years old and younger, maybe.
Thank you so much for
Thank
joining
you.
Us, Tamika. So,
beautiful.
This is a piece of this election as well, I think, that may shock America when we see the stats at the end, the numbers of young people.
It's a mandate. Definitely a mandate, just based on the turnout that we see today. I have election judges telling me they've never seen lines like that before, and we're talking at 6 in the morning, in the dark.
And in some states, Mark, we have to remember that huge chunks of their population have already voted.
right.
In early voting. Some people anticipating that up to 40% of eligible voters in this country will have early voted before the polls open today, which is unprecedented. And if you look at the coverage, whether it's on television, if you're online, even if you listen to our great stories that we hear on NPR, they are talking to young people that are standing in line. Now, guess what? Young people will stand in line for concerts. Young people will stand in line to hear a great lecture at their college or their campus. But young people oftentimes have been counted on to show up for these elections, and people have been disappointed. All over the country today, young people have stood in line for hours in the rain in some parts of the country. And, you know, I don't want to make a judgment call on who they're voting for, mm-hmm. but something has energized yes. this generation, and it's powerful. Now, another story, Mark, and probably shouldn't tell this story, but to, you know, who knows. over in my neck of the woods in West Baltimore, Park Heights, you know who the people are who are involved in some activity of pharmaceutical activity on the corner.
You're talking about drug dealers.
drug dealers on the corner. Okay. Mark, I'm telling you, I've gotten to know these people because I see them when I walk to work every day. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, a lot of them had I voted stickers on uh-huh. their collars. These are young people between the ages of 21 to 25. Now, I was amazed, first of all, that they were engaged.
Engaged.
In that mm-hmm. process. I mean, I know what other process they're involved in, but I noticed that they had I voted lapel stickers on, and one of my colleagues at work said she was on the bus coming to work, and she was stunned by the excitement of young people who she is not expected to be engaged, had went early, stood in line before the polls opened so they could vote before they went on about their day.
I mean, exactly. I'm going to go back to the ones, but I think that one of the things that what you're saying, Anthony, is really important here is that there's a hope among a lot of young people that if change comes to America, that they may be able to get out of the drug world. I mean, most young people I know, and I've interviewed dozens and dozens mm-hmm. of young people who've been involved in the drug trade in the city of Baltimore and other places as well, don't want to be in the drug trade. They'd rather do something else.
Right.
They're trying to find a way out. You know, I remember there's that one line that came out of The Wire, and I forget the character's name, but he was one of the four young boys who was in middle school, mm-hmm. and at the end he became a drug dealer. And he, I remember that line, he went, "Can you just tell me how to get over there? To get yeah. out of the hood into some new place to live." And that's the hope of most young people. I think that's what you're seeing. You mm-hmm. know, when you talk about young slingers voting, that is a sea change in life.
It's a sea change.
Brother.
410-319-8888. Did you vote today, Johnny and Arbutus? Johnny, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
You're on the air.
All right. Just, you know, another young man here in America voting for the first time, 27 years old, energized about what's happening.
And why are you energized? Tell me why you're energized.
It really is a true change, you know, about to take place. And it's been a long time coming. I mean, all of our families, our predecessors, you know, the people before us, you know, they didn't fight for anything. You know, it wasn't for no reason. And, I mean, that's, you know, today is one of the reasons, you know, why we should have went out and made our choice today.
How about your peers, your friends? Are they voting?
Yes, all of them. Every last one. If they weren't, they were today. Like, I mean, I'm telling you, like, everybody I know, and everybody in my phone, all of my contacts, everybody is voting.
And Johnny, can I ask you a quick question, if you don't mind? If you don't want to answer, you don't have to. What do you do for a living?
I'm actually a full-time musician, and and I'm in school, so,
well,
you
great.
Know, yeah, I mean, I'm excited.
Johnny, I'm glad you called in. Do you want to ask to say something? Okay. Johnny, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks.
I appreciate you being part of that.
The thing I was going to say, Mark, to you and to Melody and, of course, to the listeners is that I hope, and certainly I think there is a great deal of expectation on the part of commentators and analysis that has been taking place all day about the outcome of this election. But I hope that we hold on to this spirit, even if by some slim margin some strange thing happens and Barack Obama is not elected president of the United States today. I think that hope that you were talking about, Mark, that feeling I felt, and I know Melody felt it when she was interviewing people today, I hope we hold on to that because it really does represent the best of who we are. And I think we would do well not to place all of that on the shoulders of Barack Obama, but to really internalize that this country is as great as we make it. And that young man who just called, the way he was talking about everybody in his phone voted. Mm-hmm. I got text messages from friends who just blasted out text to right. everybody in their phone. Did you vote today? Question mark. People are taking this to heart and personal in a way that I have not seen. My stepfather is 54 years old, and due to a great deal of circumstances, you've met him. He's a incredible man who's had a great deal of influence on my life. Cast his first vote in history today.
Really?
And he had to get a permission from the governor of the state of Virginia, who granted him his voting rights back. And we worked really hard.
He spent time in prison?
He did. Mm-hmm. And in Virginia, that precludes you from participating in electoral politics or voting. And he got his letter last year that he would be able to vote and called me in tears today because he said, can you imagine I'm 54 years old and casting my first vote?
I
was so proud of him. Because he participated.
I just think I agree. This is another beautiful story, and I think this day is full of it because there's a lot of optimism and there's a sense of ownership, and there's a sense of, this is a patriotic day. We need to recognize it as such.
Well, I think this is also, you know, one of the things I'm going to go right to the phones here, but I want to say this. I mean, when I think it's important to vote because, I mean, there are people, and people say people died so you could vote. And let me just say this. We always talk about the soldiers and sailors and Marines who died, and absolutely, we have to remember them all and the people who died for democracy and freedom in this country. I came from a military family, so I understand that. With my mom and dad, we both served, and I almost served. I was drafted, but there's another whole long story with that. want to say there's another group of people who died for us, the right to vote, and those are the people who fought in the civil rights movement, who stood up down south to change things, I remember in the summer of 64, 36 people, some of whom I know, died in Mississippi fighting for people's right to vote. All the abolitionists went before them for 100 years to fight for freedom in this country. That's why we have to vote. You have to vote. We're standing on their shoulders.
Absolutely have to.
If you have
to.
Not voted yet, get in your car.
Shame.
Get on your bicycle. Go vote.
Go do it, please.
Go vote now. 410-319-8888. Cassandra in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello and good evening. I just wanted to call and kind of echo what Anthony said. You know, in my community, I'm from East Baltimore, and it was just extremely exciting to see and to be among, you know, the different people, different walks of life, and it was just amazing to see. I'll use kind of like a term that there were people who, like Anthony said, who have, you can clearly see they're, you know, they perhaps are dealing with, you know, issues with drugs and maybe even drunkenness and different things like that. But it was just so overwhelming to be shoulder to shoulder, well, in that line. but it was amazing. And I really felt victorious in standing in that line. And again, I just hope that, you know, we can just hold true. I'm a young voter as well. I've been voting for probably the last several years, as long as I could vote. And I'm 29, by the way, and, you know, it's just amazing to see how there were new voters, you know, 18-year-olders. They were just bright-eyed, and, you know, among the neighborhood that we live in is not one of the most sought after, if you will. You know, it's not the greatest area to live in. You know, we see rats running across the street. We see boarded-up houses that we live next to. But, you know, I was completely touched and completely excited about just the spirit that was in the air, and you know how everybody kind of got together mm-hmm. and wanted to work towards change. And so now, after, you know, and hopefully, you know, Barack will be our next president, and you know, but we have to have that same spirit tomorrow when we wake up. How are we going to really create change? How are we really going to carry out you know, the hope that we need? So I really appreciate your show tonight, and thank you guys so much.
Cassandra, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Anthony McCarthy.
How long did you have to wait in line today? Was it a long line?
I think I waited. I voted at the Mason Hall. I waited for about, on Gorsuch Avenue, I waited for about, it felt like an hour and a half.
Wow.
But I really couldn't even tell how long. I know it was about an hour, definitely.
Wow.
Mm. But it was just awesome just to hear the stories and to see people so excited. And like I said, you saw young mothers with children, you saw the children were even so excited. I asked one little boy about 5 years old. I said, who are you voting for? And he said, Barack Obama, in a loud voice. So the story, you know, there were so many people who just, they really desire change and they just need the opportunity. So thank you, guys.
Thank you, Cassandra. There was an interesting story I heard today that Kratovich? No, yeah, who's running in the first? Kratovich was running in the first congressional district. Was out with the county executive of Baltimore County. I think it was in Parkville today, in an area that was always voted very conservative Republican, and everybody they spoke to was voting for Frank Kratovich. That's we've heard all kinds of rumors. This election is very tight between Andy Harris and Frank Kratovich, and I've heard a lot from people. I heard one. This is off the record because I can't confirm that it's real or not, but somebody who works in the Republican Party saying that Andy Harris's campaign is very nervous about this election. They thought they were going to win it. They're not so sure now, and the credible people are being more and more optimistic. They think they'll get 60% of the vote in the Eastern Shore. We'll see. There's all kinds of stuff going on out here that we are not quite sure what it is. Let's get me inspired a bit more before we go back to the phones and go to cut three, another young man, Michael Vaughn, who's 26 years old, and talks about someone needing someone who understands the lower class and provide jobs and housing. Let's hear his take on why at 26 he's voting.
Talk to me about today. You turned out early?
Yes, I did. I came up here like 7:30 in the morning.
So why'd you come so early?
Just get out here, get it done. You know, it's no game. It's definitely serious. So we might have a black president. You know, that would be good for once, you know. And actually, we probably have somebody that understands the lower class, you know, what's going on in the world right now.
Talk about what some of the issues facing your line.
Job, economy. Our economy is messed up. So, you know, housing. You know, what's going on with the job situations with people. A lot of people get laid off on the jobs. Been on there for like 10 years and getting laid off. That's kind of a bummer. So actually just, you know, I want to see things change for, you know, for what it is. I want to see it get better.
Another piece done by reporter here, Melody Simmons, who spent the morning out getting a lot of sound. And we'll be playing these for you all during the next 2 hours as you can hear your fellow citizens and why they're voting. Even if Melody has to leave and take care of her family, we're going to keep playing her stuff.
Pizza night.
410-319-8888. Tell us about your voting experience today, what it was like out there for you, how long you waited, the age of the people around you, the excitement on whatever side you voted on. 410-319-8888. I'm sitting here with Melody Simmons and Anthony McCarthy. We were going to speak to Scott Simon and W. Elliott. There's a problem with the ISDN line. If we get that fixed and we'll get that up and running with NPR, we'll bring on these two wonderful national reporters from Public Radio to talk with us as well. But let us go back to the phones and let's see who's been waiting here the longest. We'll go to Pasadena, then Rosedale, Thomas and Deborah. Next two callers, and Thomas and Pasadena, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I listen to your program most of the time, and it's a great program.
Thank you.
But as I listen to some of the comments that have been made with reference to hope, the thing that crossed my mind is that hope is based on inclusion. In other words, if people feel that they are part of this society, you know, one of the things that was unique about Obama was the fact that he talked about the idea that there is no such thing as red states and blue states, but it's the United States of America. And I think somewhere, at some point in time, we have to look at people as being a part of a greater society, irregardless of their plight or circumstances here in this country. And I don't think that we have reached that point yet, because we have all of these various divisions that separate us. And I think the second point I want to make, and that is that somewhere, at some point in time, when all of this is over with, I think that we need to sit down. I'm saying we. I'm not sure who that we are at this point. But I think that we need to sit down and take a look at this whole process of how people get into the voting booth and how the elections are done. I mean, you know, one of the things that we take a great deal of pleasure in doing, and that is spreading, quote, spreading democracy around the world, and we're supposed to be the forebearers of the voting process. And when you look at the lousy system of voting that we have in this country in terms of people just going, exercising their right, we need to sit down and take a look at that and overhaul this whole process. I mean, you know, it really shouldn't take any longer than 10 or 15 minutes at the most to walk into a voting booth and vote. And it's ridiculous when you think about the idea that, you know, we have these long lines. And I know that, yes, it's important that you stand in line and exercise your right to vote. I understand that perfectly. But I also understand that this is supposed to be, it is supposed to be the greatest country in the world. And if it's the greatest country in the world, with all of the technology and electronics and so forth and on, we need to overhaul our system to where this becomes much more of a reality. But I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for your show and the people who are on. You're doing a great job. And those people who have called in, my heart goes out for you because, you know what? I think you are motivated. I think one of the reasons that you're motivated to stand in line and go out and vote and do what you have to do is simply because you feel some kind of a unity, some kind of worth. Your self-worth has been increased. I think your self-worth has been increased.
Thomas, I'm glad you held on and joined us. I had a great deal to say, and I appreciate your being part of this conversation. I want to come back to your thoughts in a minute, but right now I have to go to our NPR guests who have joined us. We're going to be talking for a few minutes here with Scott Simon, who's host of Weekend Edition Saturday on National Public Radio, and Debbie Elliott, who is NPR's congressional correspondent. And Scott and Debbie, welcome. We've got to have you with us.
How are you?
Thank you.
It is a pleasure for me to hear your voice back on the air.
It's great to be back on the air, Scott.
I followed that terrible dispute. I'm so glad you're on a great station. Good to have you back on the air.
Thank you, Scott. It means a lot coming from you, and I'm glad to be back on the air. And I was dying to hear what you both thought about what's going on. Scott, let me start with you, and then before we go to Debbie Elliott, because we have a brief amount of time with both of you. A lot of stations are pulling at you right now to hear your thoughts. But beyond the fact that people keep talking about this being an historic election because there's an African-American man is running to become the next president of the United States, and there's a woman running for vice president, and Hillary Clinton ran so hard for the nomination, obviously a woman, and how that is shaking on its own right. But other than that, you've been covering elections for a long time, and you've looked at elections and battles for democracy around this globe for many, many years. So, and people are talking about this being a watershed election, an election that is redefining in some ways to America. And I wonder how you respond to those kinds of analysis about where we are right now in 2008.
I think people calling it a watershed election could be right, although not always for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it certainly is for some of the demographic reasons that you laid out, and I would include, we had in Mayor Giuliani a serious Italian-American candidate,
right.
We had
right.
a serious Mormon candidate, a serious Hispanic candidate, a lot of possible firsts, and those kind of breakthroughs in the political system don't get retired immediately. On the other hand, I don't know if they're always going to be translating, you know, differently into policy. What is, I think, permanently difficult about the political system are things like the high degree of participation that we see in interest in a daily basis that's often reflected in the Internet and instantaneous communication. I think early voting. I certainly was not prepared for how many numbers of Americans in early voting states, and forgive me, Mark, for not knowing if Maryland is one of them.
We are not. We voted. It's on our ballot today. Mm-hmm. We're not one yet.
Okay. Oh. But in any event, that to me, I think, is changing, and it's only going to happen in more states, obviously. I think that's going to change the nature of political campaigning, because you're not going to be able to count on that October surprise anymore. It's going to, you know, it's going to encourage a higher degree of organization over more weeks. I also think that, you know, public finance for campaigns is dead. And interestingly, it wasn't killed by the oil companies or anything like that this time. It was, you know, it was liberal Democrats who discovered they could raise three times as much money as anybody else.
Isn't that interesting?
In little bitty pieces on the Internet.
Well, and also a lot of big contributors.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, you start contributing at this point in the campaign or as of 2 weeks ago. It's an investment.
Right.
It's people who want their phone calls returned. You know, I think that substantially. Well, you know, it's maybe people like Fred Wertheimer should talk about this more knowledgeably than me. But certainly, the next raft of people running for president aren't going to say, "And the way to do this is through the public finance of campaigns." and all of those, I think, are significant changes that we've seen this year that'll stick around for a while.
And the way that the campaign was run. You know, if you think about the use of technology in this campaign, we've never seen it used like this. At every single Barack Obama event, the campaign has everybody take their cell phone out and call a number so that they can get text messages to their potential supporters. I think this is something revolutionary in the way that campaigns have been run.
And everything that's new at some point was old. Because one thing I've reminded, I very much see Senator Obama as a Chicago ward politician. Mm-hmm. And his organization knows how to deliver a vote. And that's what they've been doing. They understood. Senator Clinton won as many votes in the primaries. They understood they could win it in the caucuses, and they certainly have understood better than other candidates that you just can't rely on inspiration. You have to make certain your people get to the polls. And that's the whole idea of sending the text messages while they're there, giving campaign organizations the chance to follow up and actually deliver voters to the polls. And with early voting, you've been able to do that over a more gracious period of time than you could before. And I think that's going to make a substantial difference in the way campaigns are run in the future.
And forcing his opponents to spend money to compete in places that they've never had to compete before. You know, we're going to be watching tonight. One of the first polls to close will be in Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, very competitive race in Virginia. You know, most Democratic candidates would not have been able to compete there. He went in, he said, I'm going to take them on, you know, on their own territory. And now it's, you know, that means Republicans have to spend resources in places that they didn't have to. So
I mean, the map, the red and blue map might look substantially different too within a couple of days. And you know, we'd all become kind of comfortable with seeing the country in a certain way. And I think that may be about to change.
Will National Public Radio be calling the election state by state as they close, or are you going to wait until all the polls close in California and West?
I believe we'll be doing state by state as the polls close.
Yeah. But we will absolutely wait until the polls are closed.
That's good, Scott. That's a good idea.
Well, some people may not, obviously. Right. But I give you our word. That's what we're going to do. Yeah.
And Deb, if we could talk a bit about your area covering Congress, what are the elections that in the Senate and the House? I know there's too many to kind of call out, especially in the House right now. But that you're really focusing on, and that you think are going to be either cliffhangers or ones that you need to watch, or maybe bellwether districts?
Well, I think certainly we'll be looking at Kentucky, which comes in early tonight, a 7 o'clock poll close, because the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, is in a tight race there. Here again, I think Democrats have taken this election to places where, you know, traditional Republican strongholds that are now in play. You see that in Kentucky, you see that in Georgia, you see that in Mississippi, certainly three places to watch. Elizabeth Dole in North Carolina in trouble, a Democratic challenger ahead in the polls going into today. So I think it'll be interesting to see what the Democrats are hoping for is, of course, that magic number of 60, a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate so that Republicans can't stop, you know, the Democratic agenda. It's not at all clear that they're going to get to that number, but, of course, that's what they're looking at tonight.
Just before we let you both go, I'm curious what you both think about how, in your analytical view of this, just watching this objectively over the years in this particular election, why is it, we saw the election when the Republicans took Congress back, and now we're seeing perhaps a sea change to the Democrats. And at whose doorstep do you lay this election in terms of the change that we may see taking place? Is it because of the 8 years of President Bush, people's unhappiness with that? Is it because the way John McCain has run the campaign, the Republicans run the campaign? Is it something we're not thinking about or seeing?
I don't mind saying, you'd be an ignoramus, and I often am, but to not notice the public opinion polls, this is a mighty unpopular administration.
Yes, it is,
and has really been for a few years, and I think that explains a lot of the eagerness that people have to participate in the process now.
And the war.
Yes, right.
The economy. I mean, as Republicans themselves have said, they face some really stiff political headwinds this year.
Wasn't it even Senator McConnell who said if we were a soap, they'd take us off the shelves?
And, you know, you begin with that. Now, I mean, I also take Senator McCain's point, which I think he might have discovered the phrase a little too late in the election to be useful, but he now said, when he turned to Senator Obama in that debate, and said if you wanted to run against George Bush, you should have done it 4 years ago. It's also significant to me that the man Republicans nominated as their candidate has traditionally been one of President Bush's bitterest opponents in his own party, someone who has opposed him on any number of issues in years past, even if they found common ground on a few things and certainly did in recent weeks. And that, to me, is significant. I do think you begin with public dissatisfaction as one of the motivating factors in voter participation and interest now.
And Debbie Elliott, would you like to close us out with a thought before we move ahead?
Yes, I agree. I think that, you know, people are going to be looking for change. The question is what that change will be. You know, one of the questions in the, you know, all 435 seats up in the Congress is as unpopular as President Bush is.
Yes, that's a good
point. So
yeah.
I think that's something to be looking tonight. Are we going to see, you know, this reaction against incumbents?
Yeah,
In the House and in the Senate.
Some of us know that Nancy Pelosi is actually from Baltimore, isn't she?
Yes, she is. Literally, her dad was mayor and congressman.
Right, I know.
When
she gets assailed as a San Francisco-style politician, what do they know about?
No, she's an East Baltimore girl.
Baltimore,
through
yeah.
and through. Scott Simon, thank you so much. Debbie Elliott, thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time with us, and we look forward to talking to you again one day soon, I hope. All right, we'll be right back after this.
Hello. I don't know what we're hearing. Oh,
we can't hear you for the music.
Okay, well,
that's more reaction than that little joke really deserves.
We're going to break here, but I want to thank both of you for joining us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We just a minute ago talked to Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday on NPR, and Debbie Elliott, NPR's congressional correspondent. Joining me in the studio is Melody Simmons, Anthony McCarthy, helping host this hour as we talk with all of you about the election and what's going on, your experiences in it. We'll come to your calls in just a minute again at 410-319-8888. But right now I want to introduce you all to Edward Luce, who is the Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief, now in Chicago with the Obama campaign. Edward Luce, welcome. Good to have you with us. Ed, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, how are you? Welcome.
Hi, I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to be part of this for a few minutes. And my colleagues are here with me, Melody Simmons and Anthony McCarthy, who may be joining us with their own thoughts and questions for you about this campaign. So talk a bit about, I'm really very curious about the take of the Financial Times and the stuff you've been, the way you've been covering this election. Well, let me just start with how it's received by British audiences reading your paper and the perspective Britain has on this election.
Well, Britain is no exception to any foreign country in being fairly obsessed with this election and fairly biased in the outcome it would like to see. I probably ought to mention that the Financial Times editorial side endorsed Barack Obama.
I
yesterday.
Did read that. Yes.
Not yesterday, I beg your pardon, last week. Also, just to sort of add in a little advertorial, which is that we do have a higher circulation in the United States than we do in Britain.
Is that true?
So we don't really describe ourselves as a British paper anymore. We see ourselves as global. With some merit, I think. And the demand from my editors to cover acres and acres of space pretty much every day on every possible aspect for myself and my colleagues to really drill down into both campaigns, but also into what it says about America, what it says about the changing demography of this fascinating country, is limitless. As you can imagine, I've been drinking a lot of Red Bull recently.
There's one way to keep going. Go ahead, Anthony. Want to ask a question? Please do. Anthony McCarthy.
I have a dear friend who works for the mayor of London, and I have been amazed by the emails I get from her, text messages I get from her. She is reading more about, not as much, I wouldn't say more that I'm reading about this campaign. But the amazing thing for me, when you said the obsession with this campaign, she, in London, reads great depth into the healthcare plans of Barack Obama and John McCain, into their plans for the war, both John McCain and Barack Obama. What accounts for that interest abroad? Now, I could be, you know, full of myself and say that America is considered one of the leaders of the free world. And so as the president of the United States goes, the world is very interested in that. But there seems to be something very particular as the energy we feel here in the United States. Your folks over in Great Britain seem to be very interested in a new direction for the United States.
That's very true. I mean, there's two things I'd say to that. One, a sort of general point as to why people are interested is because, not to put too fine a point on it, there is a general level of disaffection with the fact that the United States re-elected George W. Bush, yes. and a slight incredulity about that 4 years later. And I think, you know, like you'd find amongst bicoastal Americans, a great yearning for some kind of redemptive act that you might see symbolized by Barack Obama's election tonight, as should he win tonight. But more particularly on the healthcare point you made from the text you're getting from Boris Johnson's advisor, I think there is also a level of incredulity that a country as wealthy and as sophisticated as the United States would still have 47 million people without health insurance. And indeed, many of those who do have health insurance, you know, are facing such high co-pays and deductibles that isn't even seen abroad amongst the more sophisticated observers of America as adequate. And I think, you know, when you look at the numbers, when you look at the proportion of gross domestic product, the American economy devotes to healthcare, and compare and contrast that with the healthcare outcomes the United States achieves, which you know, are very much within the OECD average, whereas the spending is right up there at the top. No one comes near America's spending. It's 14-15% mm-hmm. of GDP. I think there is a great concern that this is a mismatch between resources and outcomes, and that it's something America needs to address, and a great fascination in how America would address that, you know, depending on which candidate gets elected tonight.
Edward Luce is our guest at the moment. He's Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief, now in Chicago, covering the final day of this campaign, the Obama campaign. He writes, as I said, for the Washington Bureau. He's a Washington Bureau Chief for Financial Times, as we know, as the pink paper.
That's right.
Salmon-colored.
I'm so sorry, Edward. Salmon-colored.
We don't want to get
pink may have a different connotation.
Politically, any other way, many other ways, be careful. But I'd like to talk about your kind of own analysis of watching this campaign and talk about how you observe this. I mean, this is historic in many ways, obviously, because an African-American may become the next president of the United States of America, which is in its own right huge. But it also, there's a shifting demographic in America. There's a shifting demographic also throughout the Western world and Europe. And in Britain itself, and I just this, people look at this also as a kind of, in some ways, a cultural and political sea change that could be happening, and I wonder how you see that analytically as you cover this election.
There are so many sort of inflection points that have come together in 2008, and I think David Brooks summarized some of them very well in his New York Times column this morning. There's the age cohort one. You know, this is the first post baby boomer, were Mr. Obama to be elected, and of course were Mr. McCain the first pre baby boomer for quite a long time. that's one thing. That sort of cultural shift is quite big, and I think people have picked up on that sort of secondary fact about Barack Obama. The primary fact, of course, being that he is biracial and African-American. I think, though, that again, drilling down, what's really fascinating to people about how people have been voting in 2008, not just, you know, tonight, but in the primary elections, particularly in the Democratic primaries, is how the white blue collar voter has been signaling their intentions, and how difficult it has been for Barack Obama to win that particular demographic, that very important demographic, over. There are a lot of caricatures, I'd say sort of probably misleading caricatures, amongst the types of people who pick up What's the Matter with Kansas or books like that, that there's some kind of false consciousness here amongst working class people who tend to vote, you know, tend to vote Republican against their economic interests for cultural reasons. And I think it is a caricature, but I think it's a caricature that also contains some grains of truth in it. And the reaction we saw to the remarks Barack Obama made at that private fundraiser in San Francisco during the primary campaign, before the Pennsylvania primary in April, and the way that Hillary Clinton very skillfully manipulated a reaction against those remarks, I think was quite fascinating, and it made people realize that this election is much, much more complicated than the Bradley effect.
I think you're absolutely right. I was wondering, as you were talking, Edward Luce, I was thinking that when I watched this election, right now the last statistic I read, I think the New York Times poll said that 44% of white Americans will be voting for Barack Obama, which is the largest percentage of white Americans have ever voted for a non-white candidate in America, and or for a Democrat, I should
Democrat,
say.
Democrat, that's right.
Actually, yeah. I may be clear about that. I was wrong. But there's a shift there, too, whether it's working class, middle class, upper middle class, in the white community in America, that there's a shift going on. You can see, even with working class votes, it may be a minority, but a sizable minority of those votes going for Barack Obama. So that's a certain sea change I see that I'm really kind of fascinated to watch how that develops over the next 4 years, if Barack Obama should become president of the United States of America.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the last time a majority of whites voted for a Democratic presidential nominee was LBJ in 1964. And of course, when he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, he famously said that he'd given away the South to the Republicans. So, you know, the fact that tonight, the drama of all this, you know, beyond the demographics and the sociology, the fact that tonight Barack Obama could well win Virginia, and in fact the results from Virginia, were he to win it, could well be the first sort of portent of this victory of America's first African and first non-white president, is I just think an extraordinarily symbolic, historic, generational moment in America's narrative. And then, of course, North Carolina and other places are also possibly in the running for him, too.
Mm-hmm.
But Virginia is the former capital of the Confederacy. You know, Virginia is one of the places that was most resistant to desegregating its school system. The fact that it could vote for Obama and be the first sign of his of bringing him to the White House, I think would be an extraordinary moment.
Edward Luce, we're going to have to take a brief break here. I do appreciate your being part of our program today. Edward Luce is Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief, covering this campaign, and is now on with the Obama campaign in Chicago. We're awaiting the results and bringing his analysis, and we look forward to your writing, and thank you. This has been a pleasure to have you with us, and we look forward to hopefully in the future having you back home with us again.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye. Edward Luce was with us. We're going to take a very brief break and come back with my two co-hosts here, Melody Simmons and Anthony McCarthy, to stay for as long as they can. Oh, no, Anthony's going to be here forever. He's not leaving at all.
Melody's here for as long as he can. And
Laverne, Sharina, and Mike, and other callers who are there. We're going to come back to your calls. We're going to be talking to Cheryl and Eiffel, and hearing an interview I did earlier with Marcus Miller on voting irregularities. So stay with us. We'll be right back. It's election. Go out and vote and call into us as you're voting. Vote, vote, vote. But stay with us. We'll be right back here.
WEAA recently completed our on-air fall membership drive. If you are one of the many listeners who joined us during the week, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we did not make our goal, so if you missed your chance to join and support the news and information and great music you hear each day, there's still time. Join online at weaa.org and you will be doing your part. You can also join by calling 443-885-2075. And thanks from WEAA, the voice of the community.
If you love jazz as we do, you should join us on Jazz Straight Ahead every Wednesday night from 8 until midnight when we enter that wonderful world of real jazz. That's not ersatz jazz, but real jazz. This is your host, John Tegler, asking you to join me every Wednesday night from 8 until midnight on Jazz Straight Ahead right here on WEAA FM 88.9, the voice of the community.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and it is Election Day, as if everybody didn't already know it was Election Day, which means I know you have voted or you're about to go vote. You have 2 hours?
Two hours.
Is it 2 or 1 hours?
Two. It closed. The polls close at 8.
Hey, thank you very much for that. I needed that. And that was the voice of Melody Simmons, who is doing the amazing series on truancy here at WEAA. It was funded by the Open Society Institute. And she's done a number of great stories for us out in the world of voting today. We'll hear some more of the men and women who she interviewed at the polls today. And we're also joined by Anthony McCarthy, who is my dear friend and colleague, who has his own show here on Fridays at 5 p.m. And is going to be hosting election coverage all night long here, starting after my show is over at 7 o'clock tonight. And I'll be joining him for a little bit there, but then going off to my own little watch party and take a little chill pill and see who wins this election. Who do you think? 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. We'll be talking with Sherilyn Eiffel very shortly, University of Maryland professor, who law professor, who is the co-chair of an election group in the state of Maryland. We'll talk to her about what she has seen in the state of Maryland. Sherilyn's here now. Sherilyn, you with us? Sherilyn?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome. Good to have you with us. Is that better? Can you hear me any better now?
No, it's almost like there's music on the line. Can't hear you.
See if we can get that straightened out from the other end there before we start this conversation. So bear with us, Sherilyn, and we'll get that taken care of and come right back to you. Anthony McCarthy is back in the studio with us. Is that any better, Sherilyn? Can you hear us now?
Nope.
All right. Well, we will. Let me know when we're ready, and I'll come back to Sherilyn Eiffel.
Mark, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
I was thinking as we were talking to Edward Luce, first of all, Mark, I am so amazed. You attract some of the most incredible guests to your programming. It's incredible. It's
very
a testament
thoughtful
to your production team and to you. But remember when Barack Obama traveled abroad and was in Germany? And there was this record. I forget how many hundreds of thousands of people in Germany showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to me. There was a German woman who was interviewed by NPR, and she said she really questioned whether America had the courage. Now, again, we don't know who's going to be elected in the next couple of hours, Barack Obama or John McCain. But she questioned aloud in German if America had the courage to elect Barack Obama. And she was obviously clearly talking about his race. And it's amazing, Mark, that question you asked Edward about this sea change that's taking place, not just in America, but it really – because white voters, whether people want to admit it or not, are going to the polls today and in large number voting for Barack Obama. That
right.
speaks
a
to
large
the change.
A large minority of white voters are voting
that's
for
right.
Barack Obama in America.
And that speaks
today
to the change in this country. But also we see in Great Britain with Gordon Brown appointing African Americans. You mentioned –
British Americans. They're not African Americans, but they're –
That's right. Oh, I did say African Americans. Good point, Mark.
They may be of African descent, but they're British
they're
citizens.
British, that's right. But the same thing in France, where French Africans are, you know, blacks are being appointed.
Right.
To the president of France is appointing, he appointed four women, non-white women, to his cabinet. Something is happening around the world. There is a change. And it may be, as Edward said, this new generation sees the world in a very different way. And the older generation, whether it's baby boomers or pre-baby boomers, actually are seeing the world change in front of them and are going along with this change. It's an amazing time.
It's resonating, and it will resonate. And I think we heard that from our guest.
I think that Sherilyn is back. Am I right about that? No, now we're waiting. I'm sorry. I said now on my screen, so I thought she was back. But, she's not okay. But I'm sorry. You were saying, Melody.
No, I just think that this change is resonating, and I think that we heard that, and we're going to see that. This is a new day for this country. This is optimism, and I think this is what we've seen throughout certain periods of history, that this the grit and the courage that we've seen at the polls today in a very grassroots kind of way.
Well, you know, see, I think that, I mean, there's a huge shift going on in the world, and there's a demographic shift happening. I mean, as the economy of the world got worse, many people of color from Africa and Asia and Latin America, South America, migrated towards Europe and the United States of America and Australia and New Zealand, a very European descended dominated countries, and have changed the nature of those countries. I mean, it's, you know, when this election was held in 2000, our presidential election, I think I have this right, that 84% of the people who voted in those in our election were white Americans. That is down to 2 or 3% now. And so the shift, there's a demographic shift in the world. And there's also, I think, a different kind of shift. I think America is trying to redefine itself, figure out who we are after kind of tearing our nation asunder around ending segregation, the war in Vietnam, women coming to the fore in terms of political and social rights in America. And there's been that shift. And now America's trying to figure out what that shift means. I think we're seeing this battle between kind of the sense of what used to be and where the future is taking place. And I see Sherilyn's name is on the screen again. Let's hope that means we have her back. Sherilyn, are you there?
I'm here.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yes, we got you.
Great.
So tell me, Sherilyn Ifill, first of all, remind us again, because I did not write it down, my fault, the name of the commission that you're co-chair of and what you've been seeing around what you've been hearing around the state.
When the Attorney General Doug Gansler was elected several months later, he asked me and he asked Orlin Johnson, a partner at a law firm here in town who's based, however, in PG County, if we would co-chair a task force to examine the problems that happened in the 2006 election. You may recall the 2006 primary was pretty much a disaster in Maryland. We had lots of problems with our new voting machines, with poll books. We had long lines, we had information, we had false campaign advertisements, we had lots of problems. And Attorney General Gansler was particularly distressed by his experience voting in Montgomery County without problems and then driving to PG County and seeing the long lines outside Evangel Temple where people were waiting in the rain for hours to vote. So he asked us to really go around the state, find out what the problems were, and make a set of recommendations, which we did in May. We made short-term recommendations of things we thought could be changed for this election. And we also will be preparing long-term recommendations to make to the Attorney General, things that I think need to be changed in the legislature and so forth. So anyway, I'm co-chair of that task force, and we worked for over a year on trying to kind of make recommendations of things we thought needed to change in our election system to make things better, particularly for this election.
And so what has been your experience today in terms of what you've heard going on around the state? I mean, we talked earlier for a few minutes that there have been some problems in Locker and Prince George's County. Talk a bit about what's going on.
Well, I think that people have been tremendously, tremendously patient. You know, I spoke to one woman who is a church member of mine, was voting in Lockerham, but at a different precinct than at the one that they had the, you know, enormous and well-documented problems at, where folks were waiting for 4 hours on Campfield Road. She was at another precinct. She was at Old Court Middle School, and she said there were no problems. I said, that's great. I said, how long did you stay on the line? She said, 2.5 hours.
Mm,
I thought,
wow.
That's a problem, you know. But she said, totally peaceful, you know, everyone was wonderful. And it just shows you the kind of patience that people are, you know, came to this with. They want to be part of it and want to exercise their right to vote. And so I think people came with a tremendous amount of patience and forbearance. And so, you know, I think a lot of what we're not going to hear people complaining about problems, because people kind of took it as normal that they would wait for 90 minutes. This morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, I got a call from a young man, first time voting. You know, in the presidential election, 19 years old, voting in West Baltimore. And, you know, he called me at 7:04 and he cast his ballot at about 8:30. well, he didn't say, you know, wow, it's terrible. He said, well, the lines along very upbeat, very positive. So I think, we've almost normalized and internalized for this election the two-hour wait. What we did hear about where people, you know, really felt it was just going too far was the four-hour wait that you all may have alluded to in Lockhart at Campfield Road, and we still haven't figured out what exactly caused the length of this wait, but it's obviously intolerable. I spoke with folks at the state election board, and they, you know, they got on it, and they got folks out there with provisional ballots, and they had to dispatch additional electronic voting machines and poll books to the polling place to try and alleviate the problem. In Prince George's County, very early this morning, I, you know, got calls, five-hour wait at Mount Oak Church. Prince George's County, as you know, is the wealthiest black county in the country.
Right, right.
And, you know, the voters were out there, and they were ready, and 5 hours to get into the polling place and vote. I certainly got questions because the task force tried to be very proactive about the communication that we think needs to be better between the state elections board and the local board, particularly as it relates to the allocation of voting machines to different precincts. So again, I'm not sure what the problem was. I did talk then with the state elections board about what was happening in Prince George's. When I last spoke to them this afternoon, the Prince George's local election board had dispatched a bipartisan team from their board down to Mount Oak to find out what was going on. The story had started to get some traction in the Washington Post and local TV, and they were headed down there. They were also dispatching additional provisional ballots and two more electronic voting machines. It shouldn't happen, obviously. You know, you look around and you see these lines, and we're all feeling very positive because it means we feel positive because we have such a history of low turnout in the United States that we're happy to see people exercising the franchise. But, you know, we didn't just stumble onto democracy last year. I mean, you look outside some polling places, and it looks like South Africa in 1994.
Uh-huh.
And that just shouldn't be. So I think we've still got a lot of problems, obviously, not just here in Maryland, but we see that there have been problems around the country, you know, even beginning with the early voting and long lines for early voting where people just, again, accepting that they're going to be online for 4, 5, 6 hours. There's got to be a better way. And I think after this election, there really is going to have to be a reckoning in America with deciding whether we actually think that it's important that people vote and whether we want to support the exercise of the franchise or not. And I think we have to really fish or cut bait on this.
And, Michelle, before we let you go, I think Anthony McCarthy and Melody Sims both have a question.
Sure.
Anthony, go ahead.
Charlene, I was very curious about what you said, and certainly this idea that after this election, there has to be a very serious conversation about how people vote in this country and what the expectations of professionals who are hired to manage the voting process, how they're held accountable. But do you think the conversation will be broad enough? Because there have been for years, and maybe I'm wrong, but I have read things about states who allow people to vote online. There have been other very interesting techniques that have been tried in trials to get people engaged, but not to control access and to speedy voting and all of that, but really just to energize people enough to get them involved in the process. Do you think those kind of unique democratic ways of getting people to participate in the process will help? As you said, it is ridiculous that people are waiting 4 and 5 hours. And not only that, but boy, that we are willing to stand there is a testament to, you know, to the importance that we believe in voting. But there has to be a better way.
There has to be a better way. And I think Anthony, what's going to happen, and I think one of the good things is that, you know, you've got to find some states that are willing to push the envelope and to experiment and to do things differently. And, you know, in many ways, states are in control of a lot of the processes. You know, we had early voting on our ballot this year today, and you know that a lot of states have already enacted early voting. So, you know, we've got states that are, you know, trying out things. I think we really are going to have to go back even just to the principle of voting on the first Tuesday in November. You know,
I think you're right. I think you're right.
For the life of me, it's just, you know, in Europe, they vote on the weekend. There's no reason that, you know, I think they vote one day on the weekend. We could vote Saturday and Sunday because
right.
I think we're a more religious country in many ways than European countries. But the idea of picking a work day, of people having to figure out whether they can stand in line, standing in line for 2 hours and saying, I have to leave and go to work, it's preposterous. There's no logical explanation for the talismanic power of the first Tuesday in November, and so we've got to deal with that nationally. So I think that there's some things that have to happen nationally, but I also think that locally we can begin to really experiment and decide whether we really want to make voting something that is just part of our natural life. And what I hear happening sometimes when I listen to some of these news shows and I hear people talk about this stuff is that it's almost like, you know, being different and difficult is part of just kind of our American identity. It's silly.
Right.
You know, we can learn things from other countries, and it doesn't make us better to do it in this manner. It makes us look pretty ridiculous to the rest of the world. So I'm hoping that there's going to be, you know, an impetus to move things along. Anthony, you're right about, you know, the folks who are hired to be involved in the election processes. You know, I have to say, though, I think there were really some great people who really work on this process and who know it inside out and who are very committed to, you know, providing the best possible service on election day. I do think that there are other instances in which that's not always the case, and that we have to look at that here in Maryland. We have to really look at, you know, local boards. And we had a problem here in Baltimore City with a letter that was sent out to ex-offenders who now have the right to vote, but who, when they registered, some problems came up with their registration. And we had a letter go out from the Baltimore City Board of Elections that, you know, if you saw this letter, it shouldn't go out from a professional elections board. It wasn't on letterhead. It said, call us at this number, but there was no number. And we tried for weeks to get the city elections board to reissue another letter to those ex-offenders who had received this information that really told them nothing about what they could do to find out if there was a mm-hmm. problem with their registration. And so that kind of recalcitrance, the NAACP local was involved in this. The task force was involved with it, Justice Maryland, and a number of groups. And, in fact, the attorney general had told the city elections board that they needed to issue another letter. So I wonder about this, you know, that you know, we can just have this kind of recalcitrance. It's really problematic. So I think you're right, Anthony, that we have to look at that issue as well.
A quick question, Melody, before we have to move on.
Well, Sherilyn, I think your points are very well taken. And I think also that it's just become such a political hot button. It's red hot in the political nature. That needs to be cleared away, and we need to have it as a right. It needs to be a basic right. We saw that today out, Anthony and I, when we were canvassing around the city. There's a lot of patience. There's a lot of understanding. And so I think that there's at the root of that in a lot of the voters' minds that this is a right, they want to be here, but I think to broaden it out would be very well accepted.
You know, it's funny, I have to say, Melody, it shocked me. This year I did a radio show on another NPR program after the Supreme Court decided the Crawford case. The Crawford case is the Indiana voter ID law case in which the Supreme Court upheld Indiana's use of requirement that voters show ID. And I was on the program with a man named Ron Christie, who's a former special assistant to President Bush. And, you know, we're doing our back and forth as happens. You can probably imagine what I was saying about the opinion, and you can imagine what he was saying about the opinion. You know, but I'm an African-American woman. He's an African-American man. We're both American citizens. We both, you know, exercise the right to vote. We're both talking about voting. And then suddenly he said, you know, the right to vote is a privilege. And I could have fallen off my chair. I mean,
wow.
I debate Ron Christie all the time. But it never occurred to me that Ron Christie, former special assistant to the President of the United States, and an African-American man, thought that voting was a privilege. I said, are you kidding me? You know, I'm not making it up. The Supreme Court said in the 1880s that the right to vote is preservative of all rights. That's not the opinion of a Democrat or a Republican or a liberal or a conservative. That's what the Supreme Court said in the 1880s. You know, and here is somebody saying, who's a former special assistant to the President, that it's a privilege. So I do think that, you know, we've kind of, like, lost our way in terms of people being educated about, you know, what this right to vote really means.
Exactly.
And I think that's, you know, Melody, you're absolutely right. I think you can get popped out of it, but I think it's shocking when people can believe that it's in their political interest to suggest that the right to vote is a privilege.
Sherilyn, before we let you go, if people have voting issues, where do they turn?
There are three hotlines that people can call. The ACLU has a hotline, and you know, even as I talk to you, I'm like looking for the numbers. One number is 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 1-866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R, vote. And the Attorney General has a hotline. This was one of the things that the task force recommended, that there be somebody to man the hotline until the polls close and not until just the end of the day. The hotline for the Attorney General's office is 1-866-298-8245. That's 1-866-298-8245. In addition, you can go to the webpage of the ACLU, also the local NAACP, and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, 1-866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E. If people have problems with polling places or any problem at the polls, they should call one of those hotline numbers.
And we will put that on our website and announce that before the end of the hour. Sherilyn Eiffel, thank you so much. And
thank you.
For joining us. See you tomorrow.
All right, great.
All right. Thank you so much. Sherilyn Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, will be our guest tomorrow night here at 5 o'clock on the Mark Steiner Show to do a post-election analysis. We look forward to having her on, as always. I think one of the most astute, brilliant minds we have among us. It's always a pleasure to have her on the air. Number here is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. We're talking about this election. You are out voting. Tell us your experiences, what's going on out there. I'm sitting here with Anthony McCarthy and Melody Simmons, my two co-anchors here, and my dear friends and colleagues helping us walk our way through this election night. Anthony will be here to the wee hours, so he needs a lot of caffeine this evening. 410-319-8888. Before we hear our interview with Mark Crispin Miller, Sherina, you've been holding on for forever. Let me let you on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Sherina.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm so excited.
Tell me why.
As I voted today, I was filled with this overwhelming sense of, wow, I can really do anything if I try. And I shared the experience with my 9-year-old daughter, my 8-year-old niece, and a friend of mine who's 27, who just joined the National Guard. So as I looked at them, as we stood in line today, I thought about how it was going to affect each of their lives, and I just had this overwhelming sense of hope and happiness and peace, and I've never felt that before. So
that's amazing. Is the first time you voted? You voted before?
I voted before. I've always voted ever since I was
you.
18, but I've never researched like I did this year. I've never went online to check other people's voter registration. I checked my own, and then I said, well, let me put my sister's birthday and address. I checked everybody's. I was just... I mean, I've never been this excited about anything in my life.
Can you describe for a moment for me, and because you waited so long, I have to let you say a few things, because you're really sweet how long you wait in the line. I do appreciate it. Tell me a bit about what it is that you're feeling inside and why you are so exuberant about this election.
Well, I live in Reisterstown, Maryland, and I can't explain why I feel this way, but it's just this overwhelming sense of hope and peace and happiness that I feel of the future. I do administrative work, but I'm really a teacher at heart, and I've given up on praxis, and just today has like opened my eyes to tell me that, you know what, you need to take praxis again because you can do it. And so
yes,
that's
can.
How I apply it to my life.
Sherina, yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. It's really sweet of you to hold on so long, and I'm so happy you voted and shared your story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Get
you.
In that classroom.
That's right, get in the classroom.
You'd be a great teacher.
Okay.
Teach, Sherina, teach.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 410-319-8888. And Tawanda in Columbia, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Tawanda.
Good to be on the air. I just wanted to say that I was in line waiting to vote for nearly 2 hours, and it was really a very pleasant experience. I had one woman on one side of me who was voting for the very first time, and another on the other side of me who was a young mom who had a fussy baby. But we were determined to keep her in line, and we just all helped.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm sitting here with Melody Simmons, who is our freelance reporter and, of course, is doing that marvelous series you just heard the promo for on Truancy here on WEAA that is funded by the Open Society Institute. And she recorded interviews for us at polling places around the city today. Yeah. And as always, does wonderful professional work. And we're delighted to have her here with us here at WEAA and the Mark Steiner Show. And, of course, my dear friend and colleague, Anthony McCarthy, who has his very same show on Fridays. And hopefully we'll have more soon because he is... one of the best radio talk show hosts that we could imagine. So it's good to have these two folks with me here. And he'll be with you all night long, by the way.
Exciting.
All night long. I won't be, but he will be.
But you'll be with me in spirit.
You'll be listening.
I will.
Yeah.
You know, I will. Now, we're going to go now to an interview I did about an hour and a half ago with Mark Crispin Miller about election fraud and voter theft in the United States of America. It's apropos to what's going on now. He will be reporting with Democracy Now! This evening and will be You'll hear his voice here tomorrow on the special Democracy Now! 2-hour special. It's going to be here on WEA tomorrow morning with Amy Goodman and Mark Christopher and others. But I wanted to play this tape, and it'll be about 10 or 15 minutes. You'll hear that. We'll come back and talk to our other guests as well. Melody is getting texts from her children, which means she has to go home and cook dinner. But we'll be right back after you hear this interview we conducted about an hour and a half ago with Mark Christopher Miller. So we're talking here with Mark Christopher Miller. This is Election Day, and he is going to be covering this extensively, as he always does. He'll be with Democracy Now! Covering it as well this evening. You'll hear him tonight and tomorrow doing that. And Mark, good to talk to you. Glad you're with us.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Mark.
Let's talk a bit about a little bit of history first and set some context, and let's just jump into what may or may not be happening into the world today. I mean, you wrote extensively in your books, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Elections, and other things you've been writing and things you've been saying on Democracy Now! In the last day, about the history of this, and that a lot of people, even progressives and people on the left and people who are in liberal politics, kind of poo-poo the idea that the 2004 election may have been stolen.
Yeah.
And but of course, you very vehemently talk about half a dozen pieces of evidence or more that say it, in fact, was stolen.
Yeah, it was. There was an audit of the vote in 18 counties that was carried out by Richard Hayes Phillips and a team of other researchers over 3 years after the 2004 election. And the results came out in his book, Witness to a Crime, which is very, very little known, but extremely meticulous and thorough and profusely illustrated with examples, and also includes a CD-ROM with many hundreds of examples of ballots in those 18 Ohio counties that were visibly altered to benefit the Bush-Cheney ticket. This is 18 counties out of some 86 counties in the state. Phillips and his team discovered that some 200,000 carry votes were disabled or destroyed, neutralized in various ways. And Bush, remember, supposedly won Ohio by roughly 118,000 votes.
Right.
Now, this the discovery of this evidence led the boards of election in 55 of the state's 86 counties to destroy all or part of their warehoused ballots in defiance of a court order. If that doesn't sound suspicious, I can't think of what does. But the fact is that audit, that book, is simply one extremely precise and I think conclusive piece of evidence that the 2004 election was stolen. But I want to kind of expand on the point here.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking now not simply about the last two presidential elections, but a number of elections, including some congressional races and at least one gubernatorial race. In 2002, the re-election of Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama was basically stolen after midnight in the vote counting premises of one county in Alabama, Baldwin County.
Which is where, do you know?
Where in Alabama?
Yeah.
I think it's in the north of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
There are two essays on that particular crime in my newest book, which is called Loser Take All, and that's a collection of 14 essays by different hands, taking a look at the broad range of elections that have quite clearly been stolen. There was also Max Cleland's stolen re-election in Georgia in 2002. To date, we have the testimony of three whistleblowers, two of them on the record, who have confirmed that just days before the election in Georgia in 2002, when Cleland had a considerable lead in pre-election polls, the president of the voting machine division of Diebold flew in from Texas to supervise the placement of an illegal software patch on every single voting machine in two very populous Democratic counties in the state of Georgia. And he told the people doing this surreptitious work not to tell anyone from the state that they were doing it.
When you say he told people to do this, I want to jump in for just a minute just to kind of
sure.
clear this up. I mean, I do want to have some time to talk about what's going on right now and what's
absolutely
on your blog today. But how separate this for from your perspective between people saying, "Oh, this is just disgruntled Democrats talking about they lost Max Cleland in a clean, fair fight." But where's the proof that this suppression took place? Who's orchestrating it? Who did it? And I mean, where's how do you put this in black and white in front of people to say, "Here's the proof it happened"?
Sure. Well, the people. Let's talk about the people who've confirmed it. If you want to accuse them of some kind of partisan grudge. The first two people to come forward were not. I don't think they're Democrats, but they were employees of the Diebold Corporation. A guy named Rob Behler, B-E-H-L-E-R, first went public with this story, which was reported on Nightline and nowhere else other than a website called Black Box Voting. And the second guy who came forward was another Diebold employee named Chris Hood. If people want to get a clear sense of Hood's testimony and of his attitude, which I think is completely apolitical, they can go to the website for Velvet Revolution, and there they'll find a video interview with Hood basically laying the whole thing out. The Secretary of State in Georgia also complained to the Diebold Corporation about the placement of this illegal patch, and rejected the company's explanation that this was simply something they had to do in order to make sure the machines worked properly. The third whistleblower is somebody in the Secretary of State's office in Georgia. I don't know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing has been confirmed by a fourth person named Stephen Spoonamore, S-P-O-O-N-A-M-O-R-E, right. And he's a conservative Republican. He's a whistleblower who has been coming out with some really remarkable revelations over the last several months.
He's in that new documentary, Standing America, Stealing America, Vote by Vote, by Lynn Lands, right?
Yeah, Lynn Lands and Dorothy Fadiman, right. I know Spoonamore. He is quite a conservative Republican. He has a military background. He was a McCain supporter until some months ago. And he's a straight shooter. I mean, he, like several other, you know, conservative Republicans who are part of this movement, really cares about the integrity of the democratic system, you know?
Well, let me ask you, then why do you think, if that's all this is correct and true, mm-hmm. then why haven't organizations like Max Cleland's group or his campaign committee or the Georgia Democrats or the National Democratic, DNC, why haven't they filed suit?
Well, that's a very good question, Mark. That's kind of like the $64,000 question. Cleland has been quite depressed, clinically depressed, since this thing happened, I'm told by friends of his, and he just won't talk about it. I spoke to Kerry myself in October of 2005.
You're talking about Senator Kerry?
Senator John Kerry.
Kerry, right.
And we discussed the Ohio election, and to my astonishment, he told me he thought it was stolen. I tell this whole story in the afterword to the paperback edition of Fooled Again, which I recommend to you because it happens to deal precisely with the question you're raising. Why are so many Democrats so averse to talking about this? When I went public with what Kerry told me on October 28, 2005, I talked about it on Democracy Now! A week later. His office immediately and categorically denied we'd ever had the conversation. The short answer to your question is that I believe that with a few exceptions, because there are some Democrats who do talk about this and try to call attention to it, and I can name them, but with the exception of those very few, most of the Democrats just don't want to go there. They don't want to think about it. I think that the implications of this are simply too big. They're too devastating. And it's a lot easier, especially for particularly corrupt Democrats, because there are a number of them at the state level, at the congressional level, who are sort of in the tank. It's just easier to say it's not happening. And if you want a good analogy to understand that kind of denial, I think you only have to look at the Social Democrats in Germany in the 30s. They had the same... Their eyes were closed in the same way. They didn't want to go there. They didn't want to look at what was happening. I actually believe, you know, because I'm not a Democrat, Mark.
I know that.
I am not a Democrat primarily because of the party's stance on this all-important issue. As far as I'm concerned, this is not just a major story. This is the major story. I mean, this is the most important thing. I don't really care what people's issues may happen to be, because people have a whole range of issues, their favorite issues, their pet issues. If we don't have the power and the right to elect our representatives, and more importantly, to kick them out when we're unhappy with what they're doing in our name, we can't make progress on any other front. I am as mystified as you are, to be honest, by the Democrats' silence, and the only explanation I can come up with is that they simply don't want to face it. I had a conversation with my Congressman Jerry Nadler also, in which he suddenly turned very vague and evasive and changed the subject and clearly just didn't want to get into it. And this is a problem. This is why we are at this moment today talking about the very real possibility that this election may be stolen.
Let me ask you about this directly, though, because it may just remind our listeners we're talking to Mark Crispin Miller at the moment, who's a New York University professor of media studies who's written the book Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election, and more recently, Loser Take All, a collection of essays by people about stealing the elections that have come before us. And he on his website, Mark Crispin Miller, blogspot.com, there's a piece on there right now. Is the election about to be stolen in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere? And Greg Palast, reporter, and Robert Kennedy are both saying that the 2008 election may have already been stolen. We'll see what the election results tell us later tonight. We recorded this interview about an hour ago with Mark Crispin Miller. So let's talk about what's going on right now, Mark.
Yeah, I actually don't subscribe to Greg and Bobby's line that it may already have been stolen, because that strikes me as a demoralizing way to talk about it. But I do think that there is no question that there's been a tremendous amount of disenfranchisement over the last couple of years. And we're seeing the fruits of that right now, that there are reports from all over the country from people, even here in New York, who had checked their registration, were registered, had voted in the last election, and then show up at the polling places and are told you're not registered. There are e-voting machine problems, I know, all over Maryland, but all over the country. And from my study of the reports on what's been happening, there's a very good piece posted on Computer World's website, for example. These seem to be occurring inordinately in Democratic precincts, in Pittsburgh, in Philadelphia, in parts of states where there are mostly Democratic voters. There are under the usual undersupply of voting machines in those precincts in particular, so that there are very long lines where African Americans and Hispanic voters and students find that they have to wait for hours and hours. This is something that it's kind of a replay of what we saw nationwide 4 years ago. The good thing is that now I think the media is somewhat more inclined to pay attention to what's going on, and we have a lot more great advocacy groups out there doing voter protection. But, you reap what you sow. If you turn away from something for a long, long time, it's not going to get any better by itself, you know.
Talk a bit about, before we end this, the conversation for now, and we'll come back to this in the next weeks with you, I hope, but talk a bit about who's actually doing this. I mean, what the idea, what the suppositions are about those that are fueling this question of either of vote stealing or engaging in some kind of electronic fraud or voter suppression. What's the root of all this?
Well, the best evidence suggests that in the case of the electronic fraud, the companies that make the electronic machines, the voting machines, the optical scanners, the central vote tabulators that they use, you know, statewide, the companies that the private companies that make the hardware and the software that we now use for most of our electronic voting are markedly controlled, I should say, owned and managed by people with a very, very radical religious right agenda. The RAP family, R-A-P-P, which owns Triad, the company that owns the central tabulators in Ohio. A couple of brothers named Bob and Todd Yurasovich from Oklahoma started the company that split into Diebold and ESNS. These are people who basically have a kind of contempt for the secular majority in this country. So I suppose the best way to answer this question is to note that in the early 90s, the religious right basically decided to take over the Republican Party. You may recall the Christian Coalition suddenly sort of falling apart and disappearing. This happened back then. Well, the reason the Christian Coalition sort of up and disappeared was that it became absorbed into the Republican Party. So the Republican Party of today is a very, very different party from what it was under Ronald Reagan and earlier. It is no longer the party of primarily of Wall Street interests. I'd say the Democratic Party is probably more that now than the Republican Party. It is the party of Sarah Palin, you know. It's the party of people who applauded what Congress and President Bush did in response to the Terri Schiavo tragedy. You know, they passed a law, they tried to force the feeding tube back into her. You may remember that the mass response to this was overwhelmingly negative, but about 20% of the American people thought it was really the right thing to do. So there are corporate interests involved, there's no doubt about it. There's certainly a strong neoconservative element, the people who surround Dick Cheney and so on, but they work closely with the religious right, and the religious right more or less consistently provides what you may call the ground troops for vote suppression, voter challenges, voter intimidation. And if people get, you know, the book Loser Take All, for example, they can read a fascinating essay by a guy named Dave Griscom about how the vote was stolen in Pima County, Arizona in 2004, clearly involved, demonstrably involved, a kind of collusion between high-tech types and members of a local church who were serving as poll workers and who were clearly engaged in a kind of chicanery that involved, you know, faking paper ballots. It's very complicated. It's all laid out in the essay. But basically, an answer to your question is that there is a committed kind of anti-democratic bloc that has been heavily engaged in the theft of elections in this decade, which makes election fraud and vote suppression today very different from the way it worked formerly.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those things have been carried out by both parties for almost as long as the United States has been around. I mean, I'm from Chicago, so nobody has to tell me, right, that Democrats the elections. And you and I,
right,
you know, we're friends in Baltimore, and let's be frank, I mean, it's not the cleanest party in the universe, right?
Right.
The fact is that kind of election fraud, that kind of vote suppression is based, you know, on the old-fashioned motivations of wanting the spoils. You want the power. You want the money. You want the patronage. What we see now, today, is a bit more ferocious and more ideological than what we've seen before. So it's a little scarier. And also, because it involves computerized voting systems, which I believe we have to scrap completely, because it involves computerized voting systems, it's possible to jigger election results on a scale hitherto unimaginable, and with a stealthiness that you know Mayor Daley could only envy.
As we watch what happens tonight in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, Indiana, Virginia, and other places, and see in these places where there are tight races both for Senate, House, and for this presidency, we will watch what Chris Miller is telling us very closely, and look forward to hearing what he has to say with Amy Goodman this evening and tomorrow. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be talking to you very soon again.
I hope so, Mark. Thanks for calling.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was a conversation I had earlier with Mark Chris Miller, NYU professor of media studies. You can hear on Amy Goodman tomorrow morning and this evening on the web. And he'll be covering whatever goes on in terms of those glitches around the country. I'm joined in the studio now by Kevin Zietz and Richard Batts. Kevin Zietz is the executive director of the Campaign for Fresh Air and Clean Politics. I like that title. Co-founder,
I like that.
Of Maryland.
I like that.
Richard Batts is professor of communications at Towson University and associate editor of psychology for USA Today.
And a member of the Board of Trustees, just to be accurate.
Of what?
of USA Today magazine.
They just can't get enough of you, can they?
I can't get enough. They're actually
congratulations.
People, I think people who like my company.
Somebody has to.
Yeah, they're it.
We like you, Richard.
I like you. Amanda McCarthy, you of course, it. Host extraordinaire, who will be covering this election for the rest of the evening with you, staying awake.
How's that caffeine, Anthony?
I'm
kicking in?
It's already started.
410-319-8888. Let's get a caller in here, then have you comment on what the caller has to say.
Right.
Mike, like I said, you've been holding on for 3 days. You're on the air.
Good evening, folks.
Hi, Mike.
It's a pleasure to get through. I have 2 points to make. And the main one, and I believe Anthony McCarthy made this, a number of the callers have made it, about how the young people, their enthusiasm, they want a better country, they want change. They're inspiring. I love them. That's point number one. Point number two, I want to say something about the candidacy of Cynthia McKinney of the Green Party. She's a progressive, intelligent, articulate African-American woman who's running for president. And these wonderful young people don't know about her. It diminishes democracy. We've got to do something better than just let's have the Republicans and the Democrats fight it out. That's not adequate democracy.
That's my line, I guess.
That's your line.
I want to hear it. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I was Ralph Nader's press secretary in 2004, so I'm sensitive to that issue. First on your point about youth voting, it really is remarkable today to see it. There are long lines at college towns everywhere, and there's a lot of dirty tricks going on. You know, Blacksburg, Virginia, where they told the kids that if you vote there and you don't, your parents live in a different state, your parents will lose their tax break. In that same county today, without any warning, they moved the voting precinct for the college kids 6 miles away to a small church with tiny parking, and there are like 1,000 kids wanting to vote, and there's like 20 parking spots. So there's definitely efforts to suppress the youth vote in some parts of the country, and Blacksburg seems to have a real problem with that Board of Elections head. As far as the third-party candidates, you know, there are six candidates who could actually get 270 electoral votes. In addition to Cynthia McKinney, there's Ralph Nader, who started the Independent Party in Maryland. There's Chuck Baldwin of the Constitution Party, who is the executive director of Moral Majority, pretty strong right-wing organization. And there's Bob Barr, the Libertarian candidate. And I think we lost a lot in the debates in this critical time when we're going through this really economic crisis, to not have that broad view included. And why we lost those people is because we have a phony National Commission on Presidential Debates that's headed by the Democrat and Republican Party, has an official name, but it's really the Democratic Party and Republican Party front group, and their job is to keep third parties out. They were created after Ross Perot was in the debates, and the League of Women Voters were running the debates in those days, and they didn't want to see that happen again. And so as a result, we don't get to hear from someone like Ralph Nader, who is not a Wall Street-funded candidate like Barack Obama and John McCain are. They are both heavily Wall Street-funded, so we got Wall Street solutions.
Go ahead, Richard.
Well, where to start with my disagreements with Kevin? Let me just say a couple things that they're not directly opposed to what Kevin said, because I have to say this about this election. I have found this election year to be personally very exhilarating because I've been involved in so much commentary. But insofar as the election campaign is concerned, I find it to be one of the most dispiriting election campaigns I've ever seen. John McCain, months ago, in choosing Sarah Palin, he had announced that the very basis of his campaign was that he was experienced, and he was particularly experienced in foreign policy. That's what recommended him. And then he chooses somebody who is distinguished by her lack of experience and her lack of knowledge of foreign policy, and it just belies everything he claimed about this also being the critical election to oppose radical Islam. And he chooses somebody who has neither of the qualities that he claims recommend him so critically for this election. So I voted for John McCain, but I did not vote with alacrity. I did not feel good about it. I just think that if you're going to be serious and tell the American electorate that you're serious about how important it is that you be elected for reasons X and Y, not to belie those reasons through your choice of vice president, it was just a catastrophic choice.
It really hurt him. Really hurt him.
Yeah.
I want to ask both Kevin and Richard this question that was kind of on my mind earlier. Mark made some incredible comments about a sea change taking place, not only in this country, by the enthusiasm And really the civic awakening of a lot of communities throughout this country. But we see it happening around the world, as a matter of fact. And we hope it continues to happen. But Kevin and Richard, how would, if you were advising the next president, if you were advising the next Congress speaker, majority leader, how do we capture this enthusiasm and keep Americans engaged? We have a history. And we have a reputation around the world of not engaging, historic low participation in our elections.
That's right.
How do we capture this? No,
in fact, you know, before this election, the United States ranked 120th out of 172 countries in voter turnout. So you're right. We have a bad history that way. This may be a different election. I think that the next president needs to figure out ways to really involve the public in giving their opinions and getting their ideas across and encourage them to organize. Now, one thing I have a lot of criticisms of Obama. There's one thing I really like about him, though, which is he talks about how change comes to Washington, not from Washington. How he needs to be held accountable by the people. I think people should take that seriously and get organized on all these issues. We are facing critical issues these days on the economy, on foreign policy, on energy, on the need for sustainable alternative living styles. We have a lot of important things on our plate, and it's time to really move forward. I, in fact, would like to see a democracy agenda as well. This early voting has been a kind of a slow-motion voting that has shown a lot of problems that can be resolved, and I'd hope that Senator Obama becomes president will take the step to put a democracy agenda forward.
First of all, let me say that the prospects of my being an advisor to Barack Obama are somewhat small,
but I also
want to say that I disagree with the consensus about the importance of large percentages of the electorate voting. Politicians can't say this because they're afraid to say it, but I think the average voter is just malignantly ignorant of the issues. If you ever talk to the average voter, not that there are any in my family or friends, but if you ever talk to the average voter, you are just astonished by how little they know.
Is that a good thing, though? Don't you think we should try to encourage voters to get informed, to get involved?
I mean,
rather than saying they're uninformed and ignorant and talking down to them like that, you certainly are. Why don't you build them up? Why don't you build them up and say, look, it's great you voted, now get involved and do more, and here's the information to get us out there.
Well,
I mean,
let me
think, you know, USA Today, what you're part of, I think it's part of the problem, in fact, that mainstream media that gives such a narrow perspective really keeps us uninformed.
Well, I don't think I'm talking down to the media because I think that in their jobs every day they probably know about 85 times what I know. What I'm saying is that if you listen, for example, any of you hear those interviews that Howard Stern did with voters, was it in Chicago or New York? And he was asking them what they think about Barack Obama's running mate Sarah Palin. And they were saying, well, even though he's chosen Sarah Palin, I think I still support Barack Obama. And just voter after voter who didn't know who the vice president – this was like a month ago.
Yeah, but I guarantee you that's a comedy show. And he goes out on the street and finds people that fits his comedy rap. I guarantee you probably talked to 10 times as many people who knew who Palin was and he didn't use those tapes because it didn't fit his rap.
I mean, if you listen to the program we had here today and the dozens of people who called onto this program today who are young people in their 20s who were working class people from this community in Baltimore, all of whom were just deeply energized by this campaign and excited about being part of the process. Everybody doesn't pay attention to the nuances of issues like maybe the four people at this table because that's what we do for a living. That's what we do. We are part of – we get into the minuteness of it. But people know, in a sense, what they want and why they want it. And I would rather have more democracy than less.
More democracy rather than less. That's a great wrap.
Let's operationalize this. And it's speculative. What percent of the public do you think – could articulate the issue of the surge? Okay, the surge was a major Republican issue in this campaign. I'm just asking for speculation.
Even Senator McCain got that wrong. When he was asked about it, he actually misdefined its effect and stuff. I kind of have a hard time accepting someone who voted for Senator McCain as someone whose judgment I would trust. To tell you the truth, if you want to talk down to voters, I would have problems with someone who voted for McCain Palin.
You have to understand, I don't accept that stipulation. Good Lord.
But you can't expect people to understand things like the surge when the press doesn't even cover it correctly.
Yes, you're correct on that.
In other words, you and the candidates both mythologized the surge.
That's right. That's
saying
exactly.
The surge worked.
Exactly.
The surge worked.
Right.
The surge didn't work. I mean, the surge is part of what kept the violence down, but then Mukhtar al-Sadr decided he was going to call down his forces, and the Sunni
paid off a lot of people.
The Sunni militias. Mm-hmm. got right. sick of Al-Qaeda. They wanted to right. take on Al-Qaeda. Right. There are lots of, so there's a lot of complexity. So
there is. There know. Is.
And work, two, and work, what does that mean? Work means it brought Iraq violence down to civil war level.
Let us bring this back to where we only have 90 seconds left and not get stuck in Iraq today.
Yeah.
Which we already been stuck there for 5 years now.
I thought it was eight.
With 8 years, but that was too long. But the issue is we have an election where the polls are about to close an hour here in
right.
the state of Maryland.
Right.
And this could be one of the most historic elections in the history of the United States of America.
Right.
I mean, there's a sea change happening in this country.
For a while.
Wow. Richard, that.
I think it definitely is historic. I mean, if we elect Barack Obama as president, it will be a major advancement for this country. Just even though he's not perfect on the issues, he can be moved.
Look for a conservative comeback in 2 years.
I will have Richard Vatch and Kevin Teese and a couple others here to debate this out after the election. How's that? For a full hour.
Okay.
You guys can go at it. Anthony McCarthy, stay tuned for him. We'll be back in just a few minutes. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered this hour by James Tranum and Nigel Williams. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Salvador Halkias, and Charles Harris. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, a podcast, or other shows, go to steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.